Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. And this is going to be the Bob Davis Podcast radio show number 40, podcast 540. I am broadcasting live from the living room because last night I thought, well, I'll do the radio show outside on the deck because a lot of the podcasts I did this week were on the deck. And I got out there and I think I got the first segment done and this storm blew up and I had to rush real quick and grab literally everything and drag it in here to the living room. So when I finished at about 4 o'clock this morning, I just left everything up. So all my stuff is up in the living room. There's wires everywhere. And so I am doing podcast 540, introducing this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show from the living room. So here is segment one of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show number 40. Here we go. Welcome to the Bob Davis Podcast radio show. To hear all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Welcome to the deck at the broadcast bunker for this Bob Davis Podcast radio show. We're outside. It is late at night. No matter when you're hearing this, and I love doing this. I love sitting out on the deck and doing my show and my podcasts from the deck. Most of the podcasts this week are from the deck, so I figured I may as well introduce them from the deck because the sound in the background is pretty much the same. So in the wake of two big political conventions this week, we had a week in which people were momentarily distracted from politics by something called the Olympics. Despite coverage of events from Brazil this week, the presidential campaigns rolled on, and if you've listened to this radio show and this podcast, I have stated and restated that election 2016 is as much a bust as the Olympics has been for viewership and really in general. Some people don't like hearing that. If I've learned anything in all the years of talk radio that I've done, it is that people want to believe that all is well and that on January 20th, 2017, a new president will take office, the one you voted for, and he or she will fix everything that is wrong with the world. On the right, you are supposed to support Donald J. Trump no matter what he says. You're supposed to support the so-called endorsed candidates. You're supposed to hew the party line. You're supposed to bleed red, and if you can't do that, you're raining on the parade. On the left, you're supposed to support Hillary Clinton, even if, and especially if, you supported Bernie Sanders' candidacy and are incensed the Democratic National Committee chair did everything in her power to make sure your guy didn't win the nomination. You're supposed to bleed blue, and if you don't, you're raining on the parade. If you falter or question the reasoning goes, you're supporting the other guy. Do you want fill in the blank to win? What's wrong with you? But here's the thing. What if both choices, no matter how hard the party faithful work to convince their constituents on either side of the supposed political divide in this country, what if both choices are evil? What if both choices end up taking us down a road we don't want to go down, a road we may not be able to return from? What then? I, for one, refuse to spend the next 4 years defending Donald Trump, and I am certainly not going to spend the next 4 years attacking everything Hillary Clinton does or thinks or may not do. I think it is time for us to start talking about what we're going to do next. It's clear to me the American political system is not serving the people. By the way, I'm not talking about the Republic. I'm talking about the system of primaries controlled by political parties and state law that pick candidates who then compete to win the nomination or endorsement of the mainline parties and then to run in the general election. I feel strongly that what we need now is to start talking about how to create movements that can put pressure on elected leaders, that can make a difference, that can provoke a significant and positive change in the way that we select our leaders in this country, both in terms of Congress and the executive branch. It is going to be harder in the future to do this because of rule changes by both parties at the conventions, but if we want to regain control of the process, we will have to. And so it's time to start talking about what comes next. And I'm going to talk a little bit in this show about what comes next. And we're going to start with something I love to talk about: history. Now, as most people who listen to me know, I travel around the country in an old ambulance, which has been repurposed as a radio studio. And by the way, it still has the lights and it still has the siren and all that stuff. So it still works as an ambulance, but I've turned the back into a radio studio. One of the places I went recently was Western Minnesota, where some of the biggest battles of the so-called Indian Wars took place, surprisingly, and to a place called Walnut Grove, Minnesota, home of the famous Little House on the Prairie. Now, I've driven through there for years on my way out west and on my way back to Minnesota from my trips out west, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to stop in and I'm going to see what it is all about. So touring the museum in Walnut Grove, which isn't that great, but it's still really interesting, and reading about Laura Ingalls Wilder provoked some thoughts about history for this show and the podcast this week, especially Western history in this country. The settlers, the pioneers, the people who risked everything to go west for opportunity. It's a theme I've already talked about on this show and in the podcast, and it's a theme I'm going to return to again and again, I am sure, in the future, because it is so compelling, first of all. Secondly, I'm planning another trip out west, this time across the Northwest, out to Washington, down the Pacific Coast Highway from Washington all the way down to California, and then back to Phoenix. So it's going to be a mega western trip, and I'm super excited about that because I love to go west. Now, in this show, we're going to devote some time to talk about some of the challenges the early settlers in Walnut Grove and other places, in the West, and at the time, of course, Minnesota was the West, some of the challenges that they faced. More importantly, what were some of the features of the future, all the way up to our time, that they couldn't possibly have seen in those days? How do you think that our ancestors in 100 years will view our time? Well, one of the takeaways for me from this trip was the realization that technology of the mid to late 1800s, like repeating rifles and revolvers, trains, the steel-banded wagon wheel or tire that they called it in those days, even the telegraph, were the latest and truly amazing technologies to those people. Those early settlers to Western Minnesota and beyond couldn't possibly imagine our time, but we don't realize that the future is built on the shoulders of the past. And we are surely building the future today. And I think we have to stop being so negative and so fearful about the future, and we have to start celebrating our advances and the possibilities they bring. Real quickly, I'm reminded of that Twilight Zone episode where the settler is in the Conestoga wagon and they're out west and everybody has a fever. They all have the flu. And he finally decides to try to go get help, or he just leaves the wagon train and starts walking, I guess because he doesn't know what else to do, and he comes up over a hill and goes through some sort of time warp, and there is this diner, and he walks in, and it's a long and involved episode about how he tries to explain to these people what's going on, and the woman behind the counter goes, well, you just need aspirin, and she hands him the bottle of aspirin, and he's amazed, and he takes it back to the wagon and gives everybody aspirin, and they all survive. You know, that was his vision of what the future could be like. And the thing is, as new technology changes how we make things from manufacturing to farming, the naysayers keep telling us there won't be any more jobs and people are going to be idle and we're all going to die. Far from embracing our accomplishments, the so-called Luddites can only see the downside of the effects of technology in the future. I don't think you can look at what the settlers had to endure back in the 1800s and think for a moment that they didn't look to the future, their future, with hope. And then the determination to get where they were going. How do we look at the future coming up? Well, I think you can tell by the difference in sound that I was out on the deck and I was enjoying that fantastic gloam in the middle of the night with the bugs, and suddenly a storm blew up and I had to grab all the equipment and rush inside. So now the rest of the show is going to be live from the broadcast bunker while the storm rages outside. So the environment has changed in this edition of the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. So coming up, a visit to Walnut Grove, Minnesota, which is home to a museum that features the Little House on the Prairie. And visiting the museum left me in wonder about how tough those people were and how they used the latest technology of their time to their advantage. Next. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. To hear more of the podcast, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter called The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Okay, just ahead of segment two of the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show, number 40, we are live from the living room Friday morning, sipping coffee after a long night of production. And I am getting ready to head out west on my big western trip. I'm pretty excited. I did not get tickets to Burning Man, so I'm not going to be going to that. And I'm glad I didn't. And I'll have to mention this in a podcast at some point, but there's some things about Burning Man that I'm glad that I didn't get tickets, and it's kind of funny, so we'll talk about that. But anyway, I'm planning the big trip out west at some point. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to go. I got to go to Phoenix in October, so I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to go out there. And of course, I will be driving the 2000 Ford Super Duty diesel ambulance that came from xgovernmentcars.com. Thanks, Ed, once again for finding Mobile Podcast Command. xgovernmentcars.com, of course, is Minnesota's only dealer specializing in one owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. They have the Chargers, the V8 Impalas. They have the Ford Police sedans. They have the Ford Police SUVs. They have Yukons, Expeditions, work trucks, vans. If you need a car and you need a loan, if you have a job, you're going to be approved at X Government Cars. And yes, they take trades. They pay the highest values every day without a lot of bull. They also have the 3-day love it guarantee exclusively at X Government Cars. So get your butt down to X Government Cars, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North, or you can call them at 763-777-8782, X Government Cars. And I did bring the bullhorn up from the basement.
XGovernmentCars.com.
All right, here's segment two of this week's Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. For more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. So yeah, we're live inside the broadcast bunker. I've had to pull everything back inside because there's a big storm raging. And I've got the windows open in case you want to hear some thunder, or in case I get lucky and the storm kicks in while we're talking. So this week I went on a trip to western Minnesota. It's a part of my home state that I came across at night, most recently on my way back from a motorcycle rally, the motorcycle rally at Sturgis this year. Usually I'm heading back from one of my trips out west, and I come through western Minnesota and I forget all about it. I don't even think about it. And I learned recently that the biggest and bloodiest Indian battle in the struggle between American Indians and settlers took place not someplace out west, but in Minnesota in 1862. So I decided I was going to take a trip out there in western Minnesota to check it out, and I learned a lot. We think of the pioneers as heading out on the Oregon Trail, out west to California or Utah, and of course they did. But earlier, a little earlier, people had headed out from places like New York to the prairie, Minnesota, and South and North Dakota. People like the Ingalls, Laura Ingalls, Wilder's family. Every time I see what these people endured, whether they ended up on the prairie or out west, I'm actually amazed. From riding in wagons to sod huts to the wars and to the locusts.
So I always thought of locusts as cicadas. Basically little bugs that's what I thought locusts were. And I'm always reminded, I was reminded again, that the locusts were in fact these giant grasshoppers, okay? So I didn't realize how big they were. There is a model in there, and it's confirmed by the pictures they have, too. These frickin' things were literally bigger than your hand. So if you're a man, hold your hand out, you know, or a woman. But I mean, if you're a typical man, hold your hand out and spread your fingers out, you know, in front of you, right or left. And this thing would, the back legs would be on your front two fingers, your index, your the middle finger and the you know, the index finger or whatever. And the front feet would be on the far palm, like the beginning of your wrist. That's how big they were. I mean, wow. I was like, and you know, they talk about those things coming in and eating the crops, and they tried all kinds of stuff to get rid of them. And it was pretty amazing. And that's just one of the things that those people had to endure, whether it was that or the new people in New Ulm dealing with Indians. And, you know, I was never a big fan of Little House on the Prairie. I was much more of a Star Trek kind of guy and a Battlestar Galactica kind of guy. But I'm kind of on this trip right now about Western history because the deprivations of these people were far worse than anything you could come up with in Star Trek or, you know, something like that. Even though the TV shows are whitewashed, but when you actually look into the history, so, you know, this is going to be something I'm going to be talking more and more about, and especially when I go northwest, because I'm fascinated with all that, right? Understanding what that their perspective was, this was the latest stuff. This was their world. They would have thought the world that we live in would be fantastic. You know, the idea that a repeating rifle was new technology, the idea that the railroad was really something, you know, that was like, you know, the internet today. That was a huge thing. Working for the railroad would be working like working for Google. And we think of people, oh, what's a conductor? What's a train conductor or a train engineer or a fireman or something on the train? Well, that was a big high-tech job in those days. Or, you know, I don't know, the telegraph operator who had to have a specific skill, or somebody that had to run the local stations or handle, you know, any of that stuff. And I'm not going to go on and on, but their world. So they came to the far reaches of the frontier on a wagon. And when you see the wagons, you're like, oh my God, that's horrible, you know. But that was new technology for them. That was like, this is how we're going to get to wherever we're going, and we get to take our stuff with us, and we can ride. The women can ride, or the children can ride, or whatever. That was a big deal, you know. A wagon train, the wagon wheel with the metal band around it was a big deal. It could be pulled by horses and so on, and I just think about that, and I think about our world. What is our world's frontier? And so I'm really on this theme of those people and what they did and how our ancestors are going to look upon us, you know, just 100 years from now. Keep in mind, you know, this whole thing in the West really was just a little bit more than 100 years ago. So 100 years from now, how are people going to view us? I find that interesting. And then I look after that, I look at my daily stories, and I look and I see things, and what floats to the surface for me isn't the economic stuff that confirms a lot of what I said in the radio show. The brave new world that we are heading into with the new crust of technology that is being created and how it is affecting how people think and what is going to happen in the next 20 to 50 years in this country, that people who are alive in their, you know, 20s or 30s studying history in 2052 will look back to 1952 as ancient history, and they'll go to the museums and they'll see, you know, the 1969 Dodge Charger or something, and they'll go, look at how primitive it was, and, you know, or they'll see things that, like, for instance, when I went to the museum, the EAA museum, there's a bunch of old planes in there, old mail planes and stuff like that, and, you know, these planes flew at about 9,000 feet, maybe 10,000 feet. They had to get up over the tops of the mountains. They were, you know, these guys were sitting outside in these mail planes, most of them. They weren't covered. They didn't have heat, you know, and it's pretty primitive. But it was pretty new technology because they could fly the mail and they could get the mail to a place overnight. That's a big deal, being able to communicate with New York, you know, in a couple of days versus a week, you know, and being able to get a letter from your aunt, you know, or get a check from somebody in a day was a big deal. That was new technology. And we think we are living in the future because we have computers and we have iPhones. Someday an iPhone is going to be in a museum. And people are going to look at it the way they look at an Apple IIG that's in a museum and go, look at that thing, you know, look at that giant boxy thing. That was the first Apple computer. And now we have these iPhones. And we think we're living in this high technology future, but we're building the crust of a new age that is coming. And this is what I want people to think about, because it's this shifting back and forth between looking at people who were pioneers in the 1860s and 70s and 80s and 90s in the far reaches of the western part of this country, which had been unsettled, and there were all kinds of deprivations and problems. And they went ahead and they took the risk. We're living in this world where we're constantly being beaten down and told that there's no hope and that terrible things are going to happen. And great things are just outside of our reach if we can just reach out and embrace them and realize that they don't mean what they say that they mean.
If the people of the mid-1800s embraced technology and took risks, the people of the early 21st century, living in a wonderland of technology, apparently can only think about the downside of the developments that could free us from labor in manufacturing, farming, and in offices. What will people do, they cry. How will they live? If we only fear the future and its technology, how can we build a new world based on the advances of science? Next, this is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Just ahead of segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcasts radio show, I did my big thing yesterday. One of the reasons I was so tired, because on Thursdays I do my big double dip where I do a hot class and then I do power yoga. And going back to power yoga from doing the hot is really crazy. And you sweat like crazy and you're just, you know, sometimes I'm like, what am I doing? The reason I can do it is Hydrus, because Hydrus keeps me hydrated. I don't care what you do for exercise, whether it's practice yoga in hot rooms or CrossFit or SoulCycle or something like that. Hydrus will help you take it to the edge because it is a new high-performance beverage that uses exclusive nanosome technology to deliver critical electrolytes with unrivaled speed and effectiveness without the sugar in traditional sports drinks. Somebody asked me the other day, what's in it? What's in it is the stuff that actually builds your cells. And they are finding out that Hydrus helps people be more flexible. It helps you with mental acuity. So it's great if you're, you know, the people at Ciro out in Sturgis drank it because they were working with customers and standing around all day in the sun, and it made a huge difference in their ordering more. Remember, Hydrus will help you take it to the edge. Doesn't matter what you do, and of course, that is what it's all about. Join the performance hydration revolution by visiting HydrusPerformance.com. That's HydrusPerformance.com, and the link is right on the page at TheBobDavisPodcasts.com. All right, here's segment three of this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. You're listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. To sign up for the Bob Davis Podcast newsletter, The Bob Line, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. You don't think about the accoutrements of the Old West as being new tech. Wagon wheels with metal bands were called tires. A repeating rifle was a luxury and a tool. Revolvers, too. Manufactured goods, whether boots or blankets or fabric, were a premium. The people who settled the Western United States from Minnesota to California were using the latest in technology to do it. Most of them looked to the future with optimism and determination. Why, then, do we look to the future with dread?
You know, this technology thing, what's going to happen someday when these new autonomous machines and driverless cars and nobody has a job, what are people going to do? And so you're already having these politicians starting to say, well, we're going to have to give people a guaranteed basic income because they're not going to have a job. They're talking about this thing called the automation bomb, which is supposed to make you scared of automation. But automation has been a part of our structure of life, and as you'll see in a second with another story, in this country for, you know, since machines were developed. And really all they did was they coupled the computer with machinery to create autonomous things, whether they are robots or whether they are autonomous software or whatever, that operate machines that human beings don't have to. And as the software gets better and better and better and quote unquote smarter and smarter and smarter, it's able to do things that human beings can't do as well as machines do them. I see them as tools. I don't see them as threats. I see them as just better tools. Think of how somebody may have seen the factory in 1840 or 1850 or 1860 versus somebody who grew up on a farm and or saw how they might have seen some kinds of farm automation at the time. And you understand a little bit about what I'm talking about. I'm going to get to the farming thing in a minute. But it talks about this automation bomb having the potential to destroy, and that's the term that they use, 45% of the work activities currently performed in the United States and how much money it represents in wages. And we're supposed to worry about this. This is this potential, you know, horrible thing that what we've got to do is we have to guarantee people a basic income to prevent this from happening. But the gist of this is we've only seen the beginning of change. Right now, only 5% of occupations can be entirely automated, but 60% of occupations could soon see machines doing 30% or more of the work. And then later on, they talk about this McKinsey study, and they talk about 90% of what welders, cutters, and solderers and brazers do now could be replaced by machines. In food service and accommodation, 73% of the work could be performed by machines. In retailing, 53% of the work could be lost. White-collar workers may imagine that they're safe, but that's wishful thinking. In fact, white-collar workers, where autonomous software is really having a huge impact now, whether it's in communications, insurance work, offices don't need the space that they used to have because robots are actually replacing workers around the world. Now, I don't want to read the whole article, but I will tell you, I saw an article this weekend about Elon Musk's big new factory out in the deserts in California, and everyone's talking about how he's building this mega factory to build batteries. And the implication is that Elon Musk is going to create all these jobs for all these people that are going to be working in this factory. And now you're starting to see reporting come out that, in fact, a lot of this factory is going to be automated. It's going to be robotics. So it won't create the jobs that they're talking about. I mention it because it's a common thread of political thought right now that our jobs were boxed up and sent over to China. But in fact, most of the jobs lost in the last 45 years in this country are due to IT and due to low-cost labor comparative advantage, and not just in foreign countries, but in states of the United States. For example, I read recently that for almost every automobile plant closed in the upper tier in the United States in the Great Lakes region, in the last 25 or so years, they've opened one in the southern tier, right-to-work state region, because it's substantially less expensive to produce cars down in Tennessee and in Kentucky and places like that in Texas than it is to produce cars in Detroit because of the differences in cost. And that before you jump off and start, I don't want to get too political, but the thing about cars is it's better to produce close to the market, which is why BMW and Volkswagen and, you know, all the foreign companies also have plants in the United States, because rather it's, you know, why have the cost of shipping cars all the way over the sea when you can, and the potential loss of inventory, you know, if something happens, when you can produce those cars right in the United States. So it's the same thing. They're not, BMW's not building plants in Detroit. They're building them in Tennessee and places like that. Why? People don't think about that. And a lot of those plants, and this is true, definitely true in the steel industry as well, a lot of those plants are automated. I want people to think about what we're going to do when, and it's going to happen quickly, when machines do a lot of the work that we used to get to do, or we used to have to do, depending on how you look at it. I want people to think about what your kids and what your grandchildren are going to do, because new jobs are going to be invented. You know, I am worried that we have, you know, people that are saying we've got to give people a guaranteed income so that it's, they just sit around and do nothing, because somehow these machines are going to idle all these people and there'll be nothing for them to do. Well, I think people will come up with things to do. There will be new things invented that will require people, and people will say, "Well, what's going to be invented?" Well, I don't know. We don't know because we haven't invented it yet. So this fear of machines taking over people's jobs and having huge numbers of the population idled, I don't know if that's a reliable fear, and I think it's a negative concern. So let's talk about farming very quickly. Farming has used to employ a very large proportion of the workforce, especially in the Midwest in this country. But over the decades, because of technology and modernization, employment has fallen persistently in good years and bad through war and peace, expansion and recession, and they have slashed millions of jobs. Now, if you asked about any industry that did that, you would think, oh, well, what industry would it be? This was farm. It used to employ something like 60% of the workforce. Over 50% of the workforce labored on the farm in the 19th century. Now it's probably less than 2% toiling on farms. And you think, oh, that's just a terrible thing. I used to have people call me on the at the talk station and say, this is terrible what's happened. And yet, America, farming is one of the leading export sectors in the world. And certainly, it's one of the leading export centers of our economy. $100 billion a year exports and agriculture. What's producing all that agriculture? What's producing all that output? Well, you know, machinery, so that farmers can produce more and more and more with less and less than less. And it's going to continue to grow. One of the great markets for robotics and IT is, in fact, farming. New machines can do things that people used to have to do in agritech, all kinds of things that do things like, for example, harvest and spray for the farmers are now being developed. There's also one that collects data. You know, you just throw it in the field and it rolls around and collects data on soil and water composition in the soil. There's another one that waters crops and decides how much to put in there. There's a new autonomous farm opening in Japan that will produce lettuce, and the humans will still plant the seeds, but every other step from the transplanting of younger seedlings to larger spaces on this lettuce farm to harvesting will be done automatically, and they expect that the output will go from 21,000 to 50,000 heads a day. So you're seeing more and more automation in agriculture as well. So the whole point of this is not to just brag about all these great, new, wonderful things. It's we cannot see the world that will come.
Coming up, if election 2016 is a bust, what are we going to do to fix it? Next. To hear more of the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts radio show. Just ahead of segment 4 for this week's Bob Davis Podcast radio show. Remember, if you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, you really need Alpha Systems' angle of attack indicator. It's a visual indicator of your lift, your angle of attack, especially when you turn on final approach for the runway. Remember that Alpha Systems' AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Thanks again to Hydrus as well. as you know, Hydrus is kind of my secret at yoga, and it makes a huge difference no matter what you do, no matter what kind of workout you do. As I said, they're finding out it helps with mental acuity, it helps with flexibility. It is a great product. Check out HydrusPerformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S, HydrusPerformance.com. And of course, XGovernmentCars.com, the spiritual father of mobile podcast command. Don't forget, XGovernment Cars has the Chargers, the Crown Vics, the Ford Police sedans, the Ford Police SUVs. They are fleet-maintained government cars, trucks, and SUVs. They pay the highest values for trades every day. XGovernmentCars.com, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North.
XGovernmentCars.com.
All right, here is segment four of this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. You're hearing the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Remember, for all the Bob Davis podcasts, visit the BobDavisPodcasts.com. This is the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. So we're going to close the show this week with some final thoughts about the political situation. I've talked about how I think 2016 is a bust. I've talked about how I think the candidates are terrible. I think the political parties are bankrupt and run by people who only have an interest in maintaining power. How do we change this? What's next? How do we start over at a time when, you'd have to consider it pivotal, a pivotal time for this country and the world? We, the people of the United States, have nominated, and I put that in quotes, the two worst possible candidates. And I've said this a couple of times. I don't mean to be repetitive, but I think it's something that needs to be repeated and said over and over again, that these two candidates who are so terrible are a, well, I guess I should ask this as a question. Are they a reflection of the two mainline parties? Well, that's something that only listeners can determine. On January 20th, 2017, one of them, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, is going to be inaugurated president. He or she will have a majority or minority in the U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress, depending on the outcome of the general election as it impacts on the, 435 congressional races and the one-third of the races in the Senate. And if there's any gubernatorial elections, ballot initiatives and so forth in the 50 states. So I took a look at the polls today because I told you I was simply going to ignore those until we got close to the election. And notwithstanding the statements that say basically this is still the preseason, people don't start paying attention until after Labor Day. First it was they don't start paying attention until after the conventions, and now it's they don't start paying attention until after Labor Day. But so far, basically, and I'm gonna address the polling situation here a little bit. The average is that Trump is running about 6 points behind Clinton, which is not a good sign. It has been my experience that if Republicans expect to win a close election, polling should show them ahead well past the margin of error, pretty far out. Trump supporters say that his support overall is not going to show up in the polls. Well, maybe so and maybe not. And what they're saying is they're pointing to the Brexit vote as an example that we're in a new reality when it comes to polling and elections. And, I'm not going to say that we aren't, but the polling for Brexit just simply showed that it was going to be a close vote, not conclusive for either the win side, not for either the stay side or the win side. It was the analysts that took the data to mean that it was going to be a victory for stay. Now, certainly the same thing could happen in the United States general election. An advantage in votes undetected by all polls would be unusual. The other thing is that events could take a course that might benefit Trump, and that's, something that we can't predict. But the other part of this is that the U.S. election is a state-by-state election. The Electoral College elects the president. So then you break it down by state, and I advise people to do this by going to realclearpolitics.com and looking at the electoral map. Clinton has sizable leads in Pennsylvania, New York, California, and even Virginia, something like an 11-point lead. But it is a little closer in states like Missouri and Nevada. But if he doesn't win Iowa and if he doesn't win Virginia and he struggles in Florida and places like that, his lead in Texas and the Mid-South And the good margins that he has over Clinton in Missouri, for example, are not going to be enough to get an electoral victory. Now, again, you will have to watch, as I will, the electoral map, and I would advise this rather than the general election polls as we get closer to Election Day, because it's all about those state-by-state polls. And I will do more stuff to explain to you the validity or the value of the state-by-state polls, but you have to be careful with the state-by-state polls. How they're done, who does them, and all of that, because we don't know. We have to look closer at the polls in the states to get a judgment of how a particular candidate's going to be doing in a particular state. This is the only hope at this point that Trump has, because when you look at the overall vote, the Clinton campaign is well ahead of the Trump campaign. Let me take a sip of coffee here. So if Trump wins, it's going to be the dissolution of the Republican Party as we have known it. If Trump loses, there's a chance the party might reform around some new ideas. A tiny chance. Why do I say this? I say it because Donald Trump does not represent the traditional Republican coalition of internationalists, strong on defense realists, supply-side economy advocates, and the so-called religious evangelists, this sort of three-legged stool that has been a factor with Republican politics since the Reagan era. Trump is a grab bag of policy ideas and initiatives that do not mix, like tax cuts for individuals and corporations combined with infrastructure spending to stimulate the economy and trade protection. People say to me, why don't you criticize Hillary Clinton? And my response to that is to ask how Clinton's policy ideas differ substantially from Trump's when it comes to economics. And the other argument is, well, if you're not going to vote for Trump, or if you're going to argue against Trump, which, by the way, I'm not arguing against Trump so much as I'm saying let's be coldly realistic about what Trump is. A vote against Trump is a vote for Clinton. Do you want her to win? Or on the left, it's do you want Trump to win? If the people who were for Bernie Sanders are unhappy with their choice of Hillary Clinton. So it's the lesser of two evils argument. But if both options are evil, why vote for either? We keep selecting candidates, and not just for president, that we're ultimately unhappy with. And I think the same will be true with Donald Trump if he wins. I think the people that will be most unhappy with him will be Republicans, because I think they're going to be shocked at what he actually is. I think there are entire groups of voters that are operating on a self-identity that doesn't exist anymore. It hasn't existed for a number of years. I've asked people for a number of years now, what is a conservative? And very few people can give me a cogent answer. Then I will say, well, what is a Republican? And they cannot give me an answer. And I've asked, what does a Republican Party stand for? And they cannot give me an answer. And among those same people, you say, well, what is a liberal? And they can't give you an answer. And what is a Democrat? And they struggle to give you an answer. They'll tell you it's a socialist. They'll tell you, I mean, it's people don't have language. They don't study. They don't know. Now, does this mean everybody is like this? No. But it means that for the most part, the people that I've talked to really struggle when it comes to substance. And I don't even know if it's their fault. And I've talked about it a lot, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but it needs to be repeated. Basically, don't answer those questions. Don't ask, when I say what's a conservative, resist the temptation in your mind to answer the question. Let it set. Because quick answers equal a rote response. And we have been taught over and over again this rote response, that Republicans believe the following things, or conservatives believe the following things. What do we stand for? And don't answer that question. Just think about it. How do our values translate to the real world? And by the real world, I mean politics. How do our values differ from the values of other people who may think different politically, or do they? And I would say don't answer those questions, because I don't think those questions are answerable right now. Those are things that people really, really have to think about. And as a political party, the Republicans or the Democrats really haven't even begun to answer those questions because they feel that they don't have to, because when you say Republican, you're supposed to know what that means. Well, nobody knows. When you say Democrat, you're supposed to know what that means. Well, nobody knows. And that is why we have Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as presidential candidates. And that is how we have shadowy operators and wealthy people like George Soros and the Koch brothers and Google and the unions manipulating our political process. So then what's next? You know, what's the answer in all this? It's clear that it isn't the Tea Party. The Tea Party never matured to be the kind of organization that was going to build political power. It certainly isn't Black Lives Matter. It certainly isn't running away to the redoubt somewhere in the Western United States, because wherever you are, there you are. It doesn't matter where you go. So the standard answers aren't the answers if you're trying to figure out what comes next. And what I want to do now isn't so much cover the election as it's talk about what comes next. Well, that's all we have time for this week's edition of the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. For all the Bob Davis Podcasts, visit thebobdavispodcast.com. Also, sign up for the Bob Davis newsletter, The Bob Line, by visiting thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Bub. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts Radio Show. Well, thanks for listening to this week's Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show, podcast 540 at thebobdavispodcast.com. We do now have streaming, so when you hit the site, if you're on a desktop, it will go ahead and start streaming the last three podcasts. It also works on your smartphone, but you have to initiate the streaming by hitting the play button on your iPhone or your Galaxy device. Thanks for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. Thanks for subscribing on those services. I'm also at Blog Talk Radio, NGCNLive.com. And thanks for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on FB and Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Getting ready for the big trip out west again. So appreciate the donations. It goes for diesel fuel. And of course, Komodo Dragon Coffee and Trader Joe's beef jerky. People ask me, what kind of beef jerky? And I think Trader Joe's has the best, personally. They don't pay me to say that. I am an avid consumer of Trader Joe's beef jerky. All right, I'm going to have a weekend. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 540.